Welcome to the Georgia Today podcast from GPB News. Today is Wednesday, December 25th. I'm Peter Biello. On this episode, we will highlight some of the GPB stories and interviews you might have missed in 2024. We'll hear from hip-hop legends Arrested Development, get musical insights from Braves pitcher Spencer Strider, meet Atlanta-based comedian Heather McMahon, and more. Recently, Grammy Award-winning group Arrested Development stopped by the GPB studios for a performance and a chat. Formed in the early 90s and known for their socially conscious lyrics, the group has been a cornerstone of the Atlanta hip-hop scene. Founding member and producer Speech sat down with GPB's Christy York Wooten.
Take us back to the beginning. You're from Milwaukee.
Yeah.
You had an incredible family. Tell us how your parents shaped your early work and how you got started in music.
Yeah, I'm from Milwaukee. Both of my parents were civil rights activists, very integral and fighting for justice, and also entrepreneurs. My mom owns the largest, still to this day, the largest black newspaper in Wisconsin. It's called the Milwaukee Community Journal, 47 years. My father owned the numerous businesses, but one of them is Robbie's Roasted Corn, which is a very popular corn roasting booth at Summerfest. It's roasted corn, and my wife and I have taken that over. So they've been involved in entrepreneurship and civil rights since I was a kid. So yeah, that was my upbringing.
So for our audience, tell us about when you first came to Atlanta, how the culture was different, and maybe what elements you brought with you from Milwaukee, and what was kind of mixing in as you got here.
Very, very radical between justice for white people and black people. There's a very real difference. The disparities were very clear. Coming to Atlanta, it was like being in Africa for me because there was so much more opportunity. You saw so much more people rising, especially black people in Atlanta, than I'd ever seen in my entire life in Milwaukee. And so what I brought with me was a mishmash of music taste because Milwaukee is surrounded by Chicago, which house music comes from. It's surrounded by, well, we love DC, which go-go music comes from. We love the West Coast, which had this P-Funk energy, and we love the East Coast, which had this James Brown, you know, the birthplace of hip-hop energy. So I brought with me this sense that all of these music styles were important, you know, as I came down south. And then, of course, I love the South, which is the history of black music itself, you know, whether it be blues, whether it be gospel. So, you know, to be honest, it's very special to me, you know, just bringing all of that stuff together. Swing a main, night shade, no icy rain. Dog tag chain, hey, swing like orangutan. Bring heat in the winter, bring heat to the beat. I'm a chief in these streets. The history of the South meant the world to me. And the reason is I grew up spending time in Tennessee with my grandmother. And those were the most pivotal and life-shaping moments in my life. So hearing the soul, the pain, the blues, the musicianship from the South, I always was moved by the South. So I brought to, you know, when I moved to Atlanta, I had a deep respect for what already existed and also a deep appreciation for a lot of these other, you know, ingredients.
So when we listen back to some of that early Arrested Development music, and by the way, Grammy winner, Best New Artist, won a Grammy for Tennessee as well, right? So when we listen back to some of the stuff, I wanted to ask you, sometimes the needle feels like it hasn't moved on a lot of the social issues and social justice, things that you were writing about, whether it was about, you know, unhoused people to incarceration to guns, sometimes it feels like that needle hasn't moved. So which song of those early years moved the needle most, do you think? And maybe which issue still needs the needle moved most?
This is a great question. I mean, to me, I feel like music is never the actual catalyst for change. It is the thing that makes people change things. So the people ultimately have to do the work. We all have to do the work. The music can be the inspiration, but it's not the actual change. So I think the songs did what they needed to do. In fact, to be honest, I feel like we were super blessed to have such a record filled with issues and passion and artistic sort of integrity, and yet do as well as it did. And at the same time, I think culture does have to do a lot more actual action and activism to make things change. You know what I'm saying? So I think the music is just an inspiration. It's why we keep doing it, though. You know, we're now 32 years in. So these songs are hitting new ears, you know, to this very day. Not just the classics, but even the new stuff that we're doing. And I see it. Like, when I'm on stage, I'm looking out in the audience, and I'm seeing people's light bulbs going off. And like, wow, I'm not hearing a lot of this kind of stuff everywhere else, but look at what they're talking about. And this is on the main stage, and there's 20 other thousand people here with me, and this is a unique experience right now. So I know that the music is making a difference, but yeah, the needle definitely has to move a lot more. So we talk a lot in our music. I wish that hip hop could save us from cancerous cells. Now the prison busting
out the scene full of black males. Yeah, I try to keep it legal. That was GPB's Christy York Wooten speaking with rapper and producer Speech, founding member of Arrested Development. You can hear the whole conversation on GPB's Peach Jam podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. Also this year, the High Museum of Art in Atlanta premiered a new exhibit called Giants, featuring the art collection of singer Alicia Keys and producer Swizz Beatz. GPB's Christy York Wooten visited the exhibit and spoke with High Museum director Rand Suffolk.
At the High Museum of Art in Atlanta, Dr. Kimberly Gant is leading a tour of the new exhibition, Giants. She passes by colorful paintings of musicians Alicia Keys and Swizz Beatz by former President Obama's portraitist, Kehinde Wiley. The songs of Marvin Gaye are swirling in the background. Dr. Gant is curator of art at the Brooklyn Museum and talks about the partnership that brought to Georgia this private collection from the musicians, also known in their private life as the Deans.
As you can hear with the music, this show is really about artists supporting artists, and so bringing the music and the visual together.
The vibrant, entrancing show features more than 100 works by global art giants from both the last century and this one. On display are pieces by Jean-Michel Basquiat, Nick Cave, Amy Sherald, and Ebony G. Patterson, as well as stunning photography from Gordon Parks, Jamel Shabazz, Malik Sidibe, and others.
Kimberly, she was the organizing curator. She was really the person that's responsible for the intellectual capital aspect of this whole thing and making the decisions about what work should be in the show. And there was a certain narrative arc that they had in Brooklyn. But I tried very much to lean into that and embrace that where we could, but I also wanted to take a complete advantage of the spaces that we had here at the museum.
That was Rand Suffolk, director of the High Museum. He says the exhibition was meticulously planned. On the walls of the gallery, the work is arranged in a way that combines depictions of extraordinary and aspirational moments with poignant snapshots of everyday life in Black culture. And sometimes the message of the art meets the music.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
You know we... Suffolk says Atlanta is the perfect place for the presentation of these major works, because few exhibitions reflect the faces of the local community like Giants does here.
On the one hand, many Atlantans to see themselves reflected in their museum and in these incredible works. Number two, these are all world-class artists, so for anyone, it's an extraordinary experience, I think, to come and engage with these objects, the scale, the monumentality of many of them, not only the physical works, but some of the artists that are here, I mean, are just extraordinary, the legacies, the multiplicity of voices that are here, and it's just a super fun show, too.
As for the collectors who have lent their favorite pieces to this temporary installation, the deans say they want to elevate the work of artists who've inspired them and pay it forward to museum-goers. Giants is open at Atlanta's High Museum through January of 2025. For GPB, I'm Christy York-Rubin.
This year, Braves pitcher Spencer Strider curated a vinyl record giveaway for Braves fans. The first 15,000 attendees of a weekday Braves-Brewers matchup at Truist Park received a free copy of a 7-inch record featuring one of three Georgia artists, handpicked by Strider, who is a huge fan of indie music. He told GPB's Peach Jam host Jeremy Powell all about the giveaway.
It's not every day you get to talk to, you know, a major league pitcher about their love of local music. Please tell me about all of it.
Yeah, wow. I mean, I could go on for a while. This is a topic I can speak on quite extensively. You know, one of the things that we've talked about with the vinyl giveaway that we'll talk about is just, you know, Atlanta is a hip-hop town. That's what it gets the reputation for, which is not inaccurate, of course. But there's way more to it than that musically. And as a, you know, very large consumer of indie music and alternative music, I'm always trying to identify Atlanta bands that are in that space and artists, and there's so many, and there's so much great music that's in Atlanta, and the vinyl giveaway is going to be a terrific opportunity to highlight that part of the city.
Yeah, let's talk about the vinyl giveaway right off the top. August 7th, it's a Wednesday against the Brewers. You're giving away 15,000 copies of local Atlanta bands that you curated. You're the one who found these bands and asked them, hey, can we give away your vinyl?
That's
this right. Correct?
Yeah.
How'd you even find them?
Yeah. So the three bands, Lunar Vacation, Trash Panda, and Dinner Time. You know, the story behind each of them. I mean, Lunar Vacation is a group that I've loved forever, since they released their first EP. You know, in 2017-18, immediately identified them as like somebody with a unique sound that I was extremely interested in to see how their discography grew, and they'll be releasing their second full-length album in a couple months, and I've gotten to listen to it before it was released, and it makes me feel really cool, and it's just amazing, and watching their evolution has been fun, and so super excited to share them with Atlanta. Didn't realize for a long time that they were from Atlanta, so that was like just another validation of how much I like them.
Well, if you didn't know they were from Atlanta, where did you find them?
Just in the back, you know, rooms of the internet that I traffic musically.
Okay.
Yeah, just small indie group.
Some algorithm somewhere and some post from somebody.
That's right.
Or something.
Yeah, Apple Music, I think, recommended them to me based on my other listens. And you know, it was, you know, they popped up on my Apple Music one day as a new release when that first EP came out, and like I said, immediately was into it.
Cool.
So
okay,
yeah.
Tell me about the others.
Yeah, so Dinner Time, a group that I came to know because of looking for Atlanta music. Shortly after I identified Lunar Vacation was an Atlanta group, I thought, well, shoot, how many, you know, of these bands that I listen to are from Atlanta. Dinner Time was one that was another like cool indie sound, and big Braves fans as well. So they have just released their third full length album, and kind of like Lunar Vacation, like a big jump for them. Very exciting to see how they've progressed. Not very well known. I think they're gonna hopefully make a big coming out with this new album and then the vinyl giveaway. But then Trash Panda is, you know, when we started talking about this vinyl giveaway, you know, trying to find sort of lesser known indie Atlanta bands, artists, they were one of the first ones that just super unique, very groovy, funky sound, great musicians. And they had just released their second full length last year. And shortly after finding them, that came out. And so that was a cool kind of first exposure to them, and big fan of their work.
That was Braves pitcher Spencer Strider speaking with GPB's Peach Jam host, Jeremy Powell. Few people know Jimmy Carter better than former UN ambassador Andrew Young. The two have shared a decades-long friendship rooted in faith and a commitment to public service. GPB's Pamela Kirkland spoke with Young in October in honor of Jimmy Carter's 100th birthday.
As we celebrate the remarkable milestone of President Jimmy Carter's 100th birthday, we're joined by someone who knows him well. Former Ambassador Andrew Young, a champion of civil and human rights. Ambassador Young served as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations during the Carter administration, and we are honored to have him join us. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's my pleasure and privilege.
I want to start at the beginning. Good. Can you take us back to the first time the two of you met? What were your initial impressions of him?
The first time I remember meeting Jimmy Carter was when he was a candidate for governor. And I happened to be a candidate for Congress in the 5th Congressional District. And I heard about him. I must confess I was prejudiced because Sumter County was where the Civil Rights Movement was put in jail in 1962. It was a hot day, and suddenly it went from in the 90s to in the 40s and 50s. And I went to Sumter County to try to get the sheriff to let us bring some blankets and coats into the jail. And Dr. King was in that jail with Reverend Abernathy. Sheriff Chappell's answer was they should have thought of that before they broke the law. And I said to Jimmy Carter when I met him at Pasco's restaurant, "Well, the only thing I know about Sumter County is Fred Chappell." He said, "Oh yeah, he's a good friend of mine." Well, that was really not the answer I thought. But I also saw him doing something I had not done before, that he went to talk to everybody in the restaurant, seated in their booths, and introduced himself and asked for their support. And then he went to the kitchen and he ignored me and went on into the kitchen. And he came back and he said, "You can never forget the people who prepare our food." And so I was both impressed and dismissed. But that was an interesting conversation. And I never went into a restaurant after that without going into the kitchen and shaking hands and introducing myself to everybody.
Tell me about when Carter asked you to join the administration as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. How did that conversation unfold?
I knew that it was a difficult assignment, but he wanted it difficult. He wanted me to cause trouble. When I was sworn in, there was a piece of paper on the lectern, and he had written some notes down on it, which said, "I want you to go to Africa as soon as possible. Meet as many African leaders as you can, and ask them what they expect of our administration and how we might help them." Well, that was a strong assignment because I don't think we'd had anybody visiting Africa for a long time, other than the ambassadors that were assigned there. And when I went back to the State Department, they discouraged it. They didn't want to be more involved in Africa. And when I told President Carter that, he said, "But remember, they didn't appoint you, I did. I want you to go to Africa." And I said, "But they said they didn't have any planes." He said, "We have plenty of planes here at the White House. Let me know when you're ready." So he looked at Africa from the point of view of a kid in Plains, Georgia. His first contact was having a car wash to supply books for a primary school in Nigeria. And so when we went to Africa together, I made sure that President Carter and President Obasanjo of Nigeria both took part in the service. When President Carter read the Old Testament, he said, "I first heard of Nigeria when our high school class had a car wash to send books and Bibles." And when the president of Nigeria got up, he said, "Mr. President, I want to thank you for those books." He said, "I was a barefoot boy that grew up about 3 miles from there. And those books are the first books I read. And that's probably the way I learned to read." And he and Jimmy Carter shook hands and prayed together about the time that they interacted as teenagers, not as presidents, but as Baptists.
Just thinking about those degrees of separation, just being two boys worlds apart and to be brought back together as presidents. You know, I don't want to say you had the impossible task, because looking at your list of accomplishments, you've done so much. You have such a legacy. But why do you think you ended up with these assignments from President Carter?
He knew me as a friend because we started relating to each other before either of us were elected. It was one of God's plans that worked. And it's no accident that it's lasting at least 100 years. He had an agenda that he wanted to do before he passed on. And I think when President Biden stepped down, I think he and God decided that he'd be able to stay here and vote for Kamala Harris. Because I thought that after Rosalynn went, he would need not far behind. And he won't be far behind, but he will stay here long enough to cast that ballot, it seems, because he'll be able to send in his absentee ballot any day now.
Well, Ambassador Young, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Well, thank you for covering the life, and I say ministry, because I think that his life has been a blessing from God. And we are much better off because Jimmy Carter grew up amongst us.
The last few years for Atlanta-based comedian Heather McMahon have been chock full of achievements aspiring comedians dream of. She's recorded two Netflix specials and participated in the Netflix Is a Joke Comedy Festival, conducted interviews on the Oscars red carpet on E-Television. She's grown her audience for her podcast, Absolutely Not, and she's connecting with audiences on topics both serious and silly, including the death of her father and her IVF journey. I got a chance to speak with her.
So I wanted to ask you about your father and his influence on you, because your son I never had, referring to the thing he says about you, right? You're the son he never had.
Right.
In the intro to that show on Netflix, you are shown bringing out an urn, supposedly your dad, although I think he was scattered at a Waffle House, right?
Yes, he was scattered at a Waffle House and all over the state of Georgia, but yes.
Okay, so important places to him,
right.
Georgia in general, Waffle House in particular. But he's brought out, and then you talk about his passing on your special, and you make something very heavy, very serious and sad, funny. And I'm curious about how you worked on that, how you made that happen.
Well, honestly, the whole situation in real life was actually quite funny. And I do think that that's the universe's way of just like, you know, the pendulum swings super dark. But then there were moments of levity that were so ridiculous and absurd and unhinged. I'm like, God's pulling a prank on me. Like, I'm getting
pumped.
How sexy
the doctor was.
Oh, yeah. The doctor who told us our father wasn't going to make it was the hottest man I've ever seen in my life. just everything. You know, my dad ended up being too fat for the casket that we had originally bought for him, so we had to get a plus size casket. And my mom's like, over my dead body and his, am I gonna let my husband feel like he was a heavy set even going down into the ground? So we cremated him because he was too chubby. I mean, there were just so many moments where I'm like, this is not actually happening. So I obviously, as a professional orator, if you will, I said, I have to explain this to my audience so that they understand that even if they're about to go through something really dark, you have to find those ridiculous moments, because everything is so absurd, right? There is life before my dad, or life with my dad, and then life after my dad. And I think once you go through something traumatic, like losing a loved one, it completely changes you as a person. Now I feel like I'm not afraid of death. I'm not afraid of what's next, because I've already felt that horrible pain that nobody, like, my life is forever changed. So I don't know why, I just have a very like joyful perspective on a lot of stuff now, because I've been there. I've been at the bottom, but now when I'm at the top, it feels even sweeter. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that made much sense, but it's just such an emotional pendulum of now I get life. So I have to giggle about life.
Yeah. Well, I'll disclose that I am also a member of the Dead Dad Club, which is how you put it in your special. Like, who's a member of the Dead Dad Club?
Right.
Like I am. I see what you mean, right? It changes the way you think about things. When one parent dies, it changes the way you feel about the remaining parent. And you still have your mom,
yes.
Robin, who is, I don't know if it was always this way or intended to be this way, but she's a part of your act in some ways.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the next tour that I'll take out, I'm sure, is about me living with my mom. I mean, it's not normal. I was always very close to both my parents. My parents were madly in love. So I had this kind of like, we called it the nuclear family. It was like my mom, my sister, my dad, and I. And then when my dad died, I basically had to like pick up my entire life in LA, move back to Atlanta, and help us all figure out the new normal. So, and currently my husband and I, we left our apartment in New York and moved back into my childhood home in Atlanta with my mom. So it's not normal to be married and living with your mom, but here we are. It's like Three's Company. It's insane.
Yeah. And she goes to your shows. I went to your show in Charleston and she was like in the balcony and you were conversing with her during the show.
Yeah. And... Oh, she likes to wave from her balcony seats and, you know, like she is the Queen of England. She absolutely loves it. I've created an absolute monster. It's insane. Like, well, you know, people will recognize her in Atlanta and come up and take photos, and then she'll just give everyone my personal number. She's like, Heather, I met some great girl named Karen today. She's going through a hard time. She's going to call you. And I'm like, Mom, you cannot give out my personal number to everyone.
To explain the accent to folks who aren't familiar with your comedy, so your mom is from Massachusetts and your dad was from Georgia?
Yeah, my mom's Pak in the Ka and Havid Yad.
Okay.
But she's lived in Georgia for 35 years, but thinks that she has a Southern accent. So she'll go to our country club and she's like, Ma, it's rather warm in here. And everyone's like, Robin, just stay Bostonian. Lean into who you are. But she loves to say that she's super Southern. She is not. But yeah, my dad was born and raised in Georgia. And it's funny, every time I leave Georgia, like, you know, I went away for school. I came back for a second. I moved to New York. I came back for a second. I went to LA. I came back for a second. And then my husband and I were living in New York. And then the pandemic hit and we moved back. Like every 4 years, I try and get away from Georgia and it pulls me back. And now I am just leaning in and I love Atlanta so much, and I'm so proud to be from here. I love it.
So did you grow up ITP or OTP?
Well, DeKalb County. So technically ITP, but then we moved OTP pretty, like, in, you know, middle school.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did you think your Georgia upbringing sort of shaped your comedy or your approach to your work?
I think Southerners get away with saying so much. You know, Northerners are a little bit more brash in your face. They say it like it is. But Southerners say it with a little bit of honey dripping out of their mouth. And that's what I love. They can get away with saying so much and really packing a punch without being blatantly like... You know,
like, can you give an example of something you feel like you've gotten away with saying because you've added the Southern sweetness?
I mean, gosh, well, you know, they always say in the South, like, oh, we don't gossip, we have prayer requests. And that's something that I'm obsessed with. Like, it's moving back into my childhood home. We have this intense HOA and there was a guy in our neighborhood who's going through this nasty divorce with his wife. And so he sent an email to our entire HOA. Hey, y'all, I need you to pray for my wife, Tammy. Tammy just got a mommy makeover and she's not healing well from her breast augmentation. So I just want y'all to keep her in her prayers. And I'm like, this is so shady and I'm obsessed with it. Just Southerners have a way of just airing your dirty laundry and being so ridiculously funny without actually acting like it's coming from a place of them just trying to be blatant about what they're saying. And I'm obsessed with that. I'm like, this guy is just throwing his ex-wife under the bus right now of her getting her boobs done. And I am absolutely obsessed.
You know, it's funny watching your comedy. I never would have said, oh yeah, she's a Southern comedian, but I have I've heard you describe on your podcast, you came just short of saying you're the Paula Deen of comedians, but not for obvious reasons, Paula Deen.
No, we were trying to figure, I used to do an Ina Garten, a Barefoot Contessa impression, and I'm obsessed with her. I was like, Paula Deen's problematic, so let's not lean into Paula Deen. But I, you know, it's funny, I don't really have a super Southern accent. I can put it on when I need to, but I went to school at the University of Mississippi. I consider myself a very proud Southerner, but, you know, I have a Bostonian mom, so people always think I'm from Chicago. I give Midwest vibes, apparently.
Okay.
Yeah, but I ran my sorority, so I'm a true Southern belle. Don't you test me.
That was part of my conversation with Atlanta-based comedian Heather McMahon. You can hear the whole thing at gpb.org and on the GPB YouTube page. Music often takes on a deeper meaning over the holidays as we reflect on our lives before the new year begins. Following in the footsteps of NPR's annual Best Music Lists, members of GPB's news team shared the songs, albums, and concerts that mattered to them in 2024.
I'm Christy York Wooten. I am the director of digital news here at GPB, and one of my favorite albums of the year was All the Days by the Irish band The Devlins. Full disclosure, I've done some work for the band's current label, but wanted to share All the Days because it's this amazing portrait of life after losing parents and experiencing the joys of family and fatherhood. And the 11 tracks were produced by Rob Kerwin, who's known for his work with PJ Harvey, Depeche Mode, and others. I know you felt the rain coming. My other favorite album of the year just came out a few weeks ago. It's by Michael Kiwanuka, and the album is called Small Changes. And especially the song Floating Parade kind of brings together all the great elements of his music. We can be stronger
than life itself. Hi, I'm Sarah Callis. I'm the politics reporter. And my album of the year was Short and Sweet by Sabrina Carpenter. We were blessed by a lot of the pop girlies releasing new albums this year, but Sabrina's album came out just in time for busy campaign season. And I was in the car all the time driving to events. And it was fun to just have this breath of fresh air that's fun and girly and poppy. And it really helped me, I think, keep my energy up and keep a positive attitude.
Hi, I'm Victoria Evans Cash. I work with engineering at Georgia Public Broadcasting. And my album of the year, my top album of the year, is kind of embarrassing, but it's Tyler, the Creator, Chromacopia. I think sonically, he experiments with brass bands and even interpolates traditional West African samples. I'm just really proud of the artist he's becoming, and I look forward to an album every year when he releases. Okay,
I is just a box with a light of thunder in me. I'm Chase McGee. I'm the senior newsroom producer at Georgia Public Broadcasting. My album of the year this year was Imaginal Disc by Magdalena Bay. It's kind of like a concept album, but the album cover features a woman with a laser disc being inserted into her forehead. And I've described the album that it sounds like if Windows XP gained sentience. It's a lot of like cool bleeps and bloops. And sonically, it's really just like a good listen straight through album, which I really value. I'm a big track 1 to track 12 kind of person.
I'm Amanda Andrews. I'm a reporter. And this year I got to see Tizo Touchdown at the Masquerade in Heaven. I was already listening to How Do You Sleep at Night, his most recent album, a lot. And it was really so wonderful to hear it live. Concerts kind of have their own aesthetic because Tizo Touchdown's known for having nails in his hair, right? He puts them through his braids. He just looks fantastic. So the concert was so high energy. Everybody was singing the words. It was really one of the best concerts I've been to.
My name is Ellen Eldridge, and one of the songs that I liked most this year was by Joey Harkum. He's the frontman from Pasadena, and his song Art of Revenge is very guitar-driven solo work. The music and lyrics are just simple blue-collar worker sing-along type songs, and it's just a really fun escape. It's a great album for 2024. I could have been a poet, but I stayed for my
family. One by one, they left me. I'm Pamela Kirkland. I'm the host of Morning Edition. One of my most played albums this year was Cowboy Carter by Beyonce, but followed very closely by Glorilla's Glorious. What I love about a lot of the picks this year were actually some of the nostalgic elements. Something about Bodyguard on Cowboy Carter makes me think of Sheryl Crow and sunsets and roller skating. So I love that a lot of these albums, although they came out in 2024, remind me of some good times in the past.
I'm Ambria Burton. I'm a digital news producer here at GPB, and one of my top albums this year was Hit Me Hard and Soft by Billie Eilish. I think it's probably one of her best vocally. And then a few weeks ago, the Wicked soundtrack was released, and so I saw that in theaters, and I thought it was really good. So I was walking the other day when it was like freezing cold outside and playing Defying Gravity, and it was really fun. So I've been taking walks while listening to the Wicked soundtrack recently.
So my name is Mark Davenport, audio engineering department. What I'm going to talk about is a concert I saw. I saw Knocked Loose at the Coca-Cola Roxy. It's probably the biggest that genre is ever going to get of like a hardcore punk. Just absolutely massive show, probably around, I'm going to guess, 4,000 people there. Had openers that were basically already headliners. One of the best shows I've ever seen.
I'm Mark Chilla. I'm the radio operations manager here at GPB, and one of my albums of the year was Sierra Ferrell's album Trail of Flowers. She's a country artist, if you've never heard of her. She's got this great sound that's kind of like from the 1940s, 1950s, and she sounds like she's like Kitty Wells or Loretta Lynn, like one of these great, old school country artists, but she also has like face tattoos. A really great songwriter, just a compelling performer all around. I've been American dreaming.
Oh, 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 my name is Alexis Ceballos, and I'm a digital content producer at GPB. My album of the year was by Still Woozy. It's called Love Seat. It's just a really nice indie bedroom pop sort of album. And I actually saw him in concert at The Battery earlier in Atlanta this year. And it was the day after I got to talk to Spencer Strider of the Atlanta Braves. He was doing a vinyl giveaway and mentioned him as one of his favorite artists. So all that, just great experiences, and it resonated with me this year.
That was GPB staff members sharing their favorite musical moments of 2024. And that wraps up a special episode of Georgia Today. We're so glad you listened this year. As always, if you want to learn more about these stories, visit gpb.org/news. And if you haven't subscribed to this podcast yet, take a moment right now. It'll keep us current in your podcast feed. And if you have feedback, we would love to hear from you. Send us an email. The address is georgiatoday@gpb.org. I'm Peter Biello. Have a great holiday.